From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Stan Rosenberg says he'll temporarily step down as Massachusetts Senate president, while Beacon Hill investigates whether his spouse sexually harassed at least four men. We'll have the latest on that, plus a conversation with the independent counsel for the New York State Legislature. He led major reforms in Albany following a harassment scandal there. What did they fix, and did it work? And today, the MBTA wants to bring fare collection into the 21st century and go all cashless, but could it harm some vulnerable riders? Plus, author Gregory Maguire on the untold stories behind the holiday classic, The Nutcracker.
I started thinking the mice and the Nutcracker and Clara were fighting over a walnut, and I think, what's the big deal? I mean, come on, why is this such a life and death issue?
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey and Suffolk County District Attorney Daniel Connolly said today that they are willing to open a criminal investigation into sexual harassment allegations against Brian Hefner, the husband of State Senate President Stan Rosenberg. Now, this comes as Rosenberg said in a letter to colleagues today that he will temporarily step aside as Senate President for the duration of a Beacon Hill investigation into Hefner's alleged actions. Rosenberg also asked the Senate in the letter to elect an acting president in his absence. Well, joining us now from Beacon Hill with the latest is WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown. Hi there, Steve.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, so it's been quite a day on Beacon Hill. Just bring us up to speed as to what's happening. I understand Senate Democrats minus Rosenberg are meeting right now.
They are caucusing. They were supposed to caucus from 11 to 12 today to discuss this investigation and how to move forward. However, the caucus has been going on for over 4 hours. They've brought in pizzas so that the senators can have lunch, but they are still meeting. Makes me think that they're discussing more than just the investigation, but they're really discussing the future of the Senate. Which way do they go? Do they go with an acting president as requested by Stan Rosenberg? Or do they say, hey, you know, we want to move beyond this. We need to be moving into the future. We need to be moving on to a permanent president. And that could be going on right now in there. This is sort of the equivalent of a papal conclave going on in this room right next to me right now.
Interesting. And they're still not done after several hours of meeting.
That's right. Several senators have come out to use the bathroom around the corner. They always demur and say, oh, no comment, really no indication. Linda Dorsina-Forey, who has been mentioned as a possible future Senate president, I asked her, are you going to be it? And she said, please, and just kind of walked away from that. So they're really not giving us any solid indication as to what's going on in there, but it's definitely going to have a major bearing on Massachusetts politics
right here
at the State House.
Now, Rosenberg wrote in a letter to Senate colleagues about him. He said, I believe taking a leave of absence from the Senate presidency during this investigation is in the best interest of the Senate, and that he wants to ensure that the investigation is fully independent and credible. But this is the Beacon Hill investigation that we're talking about, not the one that we just heard about this afternoon, potentially from AG Maura Healey and Suffolk DA Dan Connolly.
That's right. Many senators have acknowledged that there's really nothing that the Senate can do about Brian Hefner and the allegations made against him. They can only deal with a member of the Senate. And they are trying to say that, as far as they're concerned, Stan Rosenberg is innocent until proven guilty of any malfeasance in terms of, giving any favors in exchange for what has happened with her husband.
Mm. And that is what victims have alleged that Hefner may have done, right?
Yeah. That is correct.
Well, so let me just play a little bit of tape here, Steve, if I can. This is from Senate Minority Leader Bruce Tarr, speaking more directly to the point you were making, exactly what can and can't the Senate do in investigating the allegations against Hefner.
We really have no ability to investigate the conduct of someone who is not a member or of the Senate or a member of the staff of the Senate. And I want to be very clear about this because I think there's been a little confusion out there about that. The ability of the Senate to act here is an ability that's derived from Senate Rule 12A. There are things that have been alleged here that, if proven correct, would indicate that criminal behavior has occurred. And the Senate has no jurisdiction over criminal behavior.
That's Senate Minority Leader Bruce Tarr. But again, as we mentioned, just today, Attorney General Maura Healey and Suffolk DA Dan Connolly issued a statement in which they said, quote, "We ask anyone with information to contact either office, and we remind every survivor of sexual assault that they can count on us to provide a safe, respectful, victim-centered environment no matter what the circumstances might be." So they may open a criminal investigation here, Steve. How might that change the calculus of what's going on Beacon Hill?
Well, the Senate investigation, what Bruce Tarr said earlier today, if that Senate investigation uncovers any criminal activity, they will refer it to the proper authorities. So, you know, they're not closing the door to looking for illegal activity if they should find it in this investigation.
Okay. Well, that's WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown bringing us up to speed on the latest on what's going on in the Massachusetts State Senate regarding allegations that Senator Stan Rosenberg's spouse may have allegedly harassed or sexually harassed at least four men, and how that is having an impact on Senate President Stan Rosenberg. Steve, thank you so very much, and keep us up to speed as developments occur.
I will do that, Magna.
Thanks a lot. All right, so here's the thing. The bigger story, we think, in how all of this or any alleged sexual harassment cases happen on Beacon Hill is this. I mean, the thing that struck us is that, you know, in Yvonne Abraham's Boston Globe reporting, and it is her reporting, tip of the hat to her, it's really been shining a light on all these sexual harassment cases. In her reporting, every alleged victim told her, "Who was I supposed to turn to? There was no one I could report to," they told her. "There was nothing I can do." So that is a problem on Beacon Hill, and lots of people do believe that that is a problem, no matter how this shakes out for Senate President Stan Rosenberg. So we wanted to know, are there ways to fix this? Can a system be put into place on Beacon Hill that protects both victims and allows for due process in the legislature when it comes to issues of sexual harassment? I mean, other legislatures have tried. Back in 2012, the New York State Assembly was rocked with allegations of sexual harassment by a top assemblyman from Brooklyn. His name is Vito Lopez, and here's how Fox 23 Albany put it in 2013.
"Good evening to you. I'm John Gray.
And I'm Elisa Streeter in for Lydia. A lawsuit filed by two women today claims extensive sexual harassment by former Assemblyman Vito Lopez and an essential cover-up by Speaker Sheldon Silver.
Our News Center's Megan Farley joining us live down at the state capitol. Now, Megan, this comes less than a month after J. Culp released a report that criticized both of these assemblymen.
So there was a lot of news going on in New York a couple of years ago. Lopez eventually resigned, but the case prompted the New York State Legislature to make major concrete changes in how it handles sexual assault. Now, that happened around 2013. Rick Rosane helped write those official reforms. He's a professor at the City University of New York Law School, specializing in employment law and sexual harassment law. He served on New York State's Task Force on Sexual Harassment, and he's also currently the State Assembly's independent counsel and neutral investigator. He looks into cases of sexual harassment at the New York State Assembly, and he joins us now. Professor Rosane, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So I'm really grateful that you joined us today because we're looking for answers on how to fix this. And it seems as if New York has wrestled with this, and so we hope to learn from whatever you can teach us, Professor Rosane. But first of all, can you just give us, in a nutshell, what happened with Vito Lopez? I mean, he was a powerful Democratic state assemblyman accused of harassing at least three women. Before the reforms that you were a part of, how did the state assembly handle the Lopez case?
Well, you know, I wasn't there at the time, so this is actually my knowledge from the outside. But my understanding is that there were three young women who were sexually harassed, both in terms of verbal conduct and physical touching and buying sexy blouses for them and requiring them to wear it and go to parties. And at some point, they saw the lawyer filed the suit, and one of the big problems was it was handled very privately, and even the Attorney General went along with a private settlement. So the taxpayers had no idea that this was going on and that quite a bit of money was paid out.
Right.
So that was the problem. And at the point that I came into the assembly to look at it and work with this task force, that was the climate.
Mm. Well, I mean, a lot of money. You are right. I mean, we're seeing reports here, again, from New York media that $103,000 sexual harassment settlement, which included, by the way, a $20,000 fine if any of the women or Lopez himself went public. So there was basically a gag order on talking about the settlement, which was what kept it secret. I was also interested to see that, again, before the reforms that you helped institute in the New York State Assembly, that whenever something like this happened and there were allegations of harassment by a member, that what a person had to do, that the victim had to detail his or her complaint personally in writing to the Speaker's Council. That's the lawyer who represents the State Assembly Speaker and the majority, and which effectively made them not anonymous and didn't provide any protection against retaliation.
That's correct, and there was a lot of confusion too. So in one particular situation, the council heard from somebody who was complaining on behalf of another woman, but it wasn't in writing. So they looked at the policy, said, "Well, it has to be in writing, so therefore we don't have to do anything about that." So that was one of the first reforms. We made it very clear: any way you hear about it, in writing, orally, or otherwise, that is a complaint.
Okay, so let's talk about then in more detail your specific reforms. And to that first one that you're saying, effectively now in the New York State Assembly, anybody who hears anything, it doesn't have to be in writing, but who hears allegations of harassment or sexual harassment has to report it?
Not anybody.
Okay.
Let me tell you, I would say there are at least five, if not six, basic reforms that are really critical. The first you already mentioned, and that is there has to be an independent, outside, neutral investigator. It can't be somebody who is politically connected with the powers that be. It really has to be somebody who can go in without fear or favor, look at the facts, and instruct the appropriate committee.
Yeah, just to be clear, though, Professor, if I may, that's you right now. You are that investigator.
That is me right now. That is correct.
So
a number of investigations.
So if someone had concerns about something that had happened to them, whether it be in the New York State Legislature, would they know that you are the person that they can call?
Yes. This is there is a policy now that it's online. Everybody could see it. First of all, there are two avenues. One is when an employee is complaining against another employee. There's another outside investigator for that. I'm the investigator when an employee is complaining that an assembly member sexually harassed them or discriminated against them in some other ways. And so it's right on top. You may call, and the phone number is right there. But they have other avenues, too. They could also complain directly to the chair of the Ethics Committee. We have a bipartisan, four Democrats and four Republicans, ethics committee that will examine my report. I will come up with findings of fact and recommendations, and they then have an opportunity to question me about it. And if they determine that my recommendations should go forward, then a hearing is set, a hearing to give the assembly member the opportunity, the due process that's required, to rebut the allegations. And there is a notice given to the assembly person. At that point, it's the first point that they're told who the complainant is, and I want to go back to that because mm-hmm. confidentiality, non-retaliation, that's a critical part of it. And also, as you were getting into what we call the mandatory reporting system.
Right.
So let me move back to that for a moment.
Yeah, because if we could, it'll help us to sort of start in roughly chronological order. And the first part that this process would be triggered by would be if someone had heard something or experienced something and it needed to be reported. So who would those reporters
be? Right. So first of all, the target of the harassment herself could certainly report it either
or himself
to the chair or to the independent outside counsel. Number two, we have built in what we call mandatory reporters, which means every assembly member, every supervisor, director of legislation, whatever, if they hear anything, even if it's only in the form of gossip or they observe something, they are now required to report that directly to me or to the chair.
And if they don't report it, what happens?
There are consequences for that, and the consequences could be disciplined by the speaker, including if they, let's say, were a chair of a committee, they could lose that chairmanship. So there are real consequences to this. And our experience is that the mandatory reporting system is working. People, first of all, they're trained about it. And I'll get to the training in a minute. That's really critical. But what's also important in this plan, and different from most plans, every federal, state, and local law for fair employment has a provision which says if an employee comes forward with a complaint or participates in an investigation or opposes unlawful sexual harassment or discrimination, they are protected. You cannot retaliate against them. Well, that's the law.
Right.
What's the reality?
Exactly.
70% of women never make a peep. Why? They're afraid of real punishment. It has happened. And so we had to come up with something different. And what I came up with was a non-retaliation plan, which is required. And what does that mean? That means the chair of the ethics committee, upon receiving a complaint, either learning it from me or from directly from the person, must draft a written plan which goes to both the target of the harassment and the accused, and it says, okay, you know, we have a non-retaliation plan. We're taking this seriously. You may not talk to other employees. You may not talk to anybody about this. This has to be kept confidential, and there are consequences if you do retaliate. And it also tells the target, because she gets a copy of it, if you feel threatened or there's any retaliation, you should go directly to the independent counsel or to the chair, report it, and we will take action. Mm.
Let me just jump in here, Professor, if I could, because I just want to remind folks that I'm speaking with Professor Rick Rosane. He's professor at the City University of New York Law School, specializes in employment and harassment law. And he served on the New York State's Task Force on Sexual Harassment, and he's the New York State Assembly's independent counsel who handles investigations into all sexual harassment charges in the New York State Assembly. So he definitely knows a lot about the changes that have happened in New York, and we're talking to him to figure out, you know, what other state legislatures have done and whether or not we here in Massachusetts can learn anything from it. So, Professor Rosane, you were talking about sort of the protections and the steps that go into protecting confidentiality and preventing retaliation in the event that someone reports harassment. But when that report comes to you, you as the independent counsel, how much power do you have? Do you have subpoena power? What's the scope of your investigation usually?
Yes, that's a very good question. My power is quite extensive. I have the power to interview all employees of the assembly and members of the assembly, and they must come forward. And in some cases, that we actually have transcripts of the interview. I'm also entitled to get all the relevant records. So what do I mean by relevant records? This day and age in social media, a lot of the harassment occurs through text, through social media, through chat lines. And I put out a preservation of evidence notice right away and ask for those documents. In one situation, actually used a forensic person to help me look into a phone, into
wow.
a phone, because people can delete things, but mostly those deletions never disappear. So I have very broad power. We have never gotten to the point where we had to subpoena anybody, but the committee does have the power to subpoena. So if I reach out to somebody, an employee must speak to me. No assembly member has refused, but if somebody refused and I felt it was necessary for the investigation, I would go to the committee and ask that they authorize a subpoena.
Okay. So once you do your investigation then, I mean, this just, you recently just had one for Assemblyman Stephen McLaughlin just last month in the assembly there. I mean, once you complete your investigation and you forward the results of it to this bipartisan ethics commission in the assembly, and then they have the choice on whether or not to act?
That is correct. The independent investigator's role is to find the facts and make a recommendation to say, was the policy and or law violated? The ethics committee then meets, questions the independent investigator, and makes a determination whether there is a probable cause that it should go to a hearing. And if it goes to a hearing, then the accused assembly member is entitled under due process to come forward and to give sworn testimony, and in some situations has brought witnesses to support his claim or her claim. And then the committee makes the final determination.
Well, but let me ask you about that.
Hold on one second. Okay. Actually, I wanted to just correct that.
Sure.
Makes the interim termination, because it's the Speaker of the Assembly who makes the final determination, but the Speaker has adopted a principle that it will adopt the findings and recommendations of the Ethics Committee for the most part.
I see. So officially it comes from the Speaker, but they take it from the Commission.
And, okay. And there's an appeal process that an Assembly member can appeal it, and the Speaker would appoint an outside hearing officer. In the one appeal that I was involved with, the Speaker appointed a former member of the highest court in the state of New York, a retired member, to hear that appeal.
Okay. So, you know, so far, Professor Rosane, this sounds all really good and very thorough. But I understand, though, that in the event that the committee finds an assembly member guilty of violating state policy, that the most they can do is they issue a letter of admonition. I mean, so how is that? What kind of effective outcome is that?
Yes. Okay. Well, first of all, that's not the only thing they could do. So let me talk about the letter of admonition first, and then tell you about other discipline that is very effective. The admonition is also very effective. People say, "Well, it's just a letter." Well, transparency, openness is really important in the process. Why? Well, from experience, we have another body that's above the Speaker, in essence, and that is the voters. So if this was all kept secret and people do not know about it, voters are not going to know about it. In one situation, for instance, after an investigation and it was made public, that particular assembly member was running for a city council position. This information became public, and he did not win the primary. And then when it came for him to stand again for election for the assembly, he made a determination based on polling and everything else, and he had been a popular assembly member before, he was not going to win. So that admonition and that public airing was really critical. And
I take your point. Let me jump in here, Professor Foucault. I take your point about the ultimate power of what happens in the voting booth and in an ideal situation, absolutely. But I don't necessarily want we could get it. I could just sort of push back gently and say the power of incumbency, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that perhaps it's not a perfect system.
Yes. Yeah. But let me tell you about some of the other discipline that's also important. So in that particular situation, one of the other disciplines was his chairmanship was taken away, and that's very important to assembly people.
Yeah.
Not only is it a loss in salary, because you get additional money for being a chair of the committee, but it's certainly a loss in power, too, because and his constituents will note that he's no longer chair of that committee. In another situation, staff were taken away from the particular assembly person. So these are real. This discipline has an important
consequence.
Impact.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So let me ask you, Professor. I mean, last one or two questions I have.
And I want to make sure I say something about training, because that's very important. And there's been a lot of discussion about training. So do you want to ask the questions first?
Tell me about the training and how that's changed, because it leads to my question, which is, it's great to have. The system that you have in place in New York seems, again, light years ahead of what we have in Massachusetts, because there's basically nothing here right now. But my question eventually was going to be, but has it changed the fundamental cultural problems in the New York State Assembly that led to you having to make all these reforms in 2013?
That's a great question, and such an important issue. So not only do we have to change the structures of policy and law, we also have to change the culture. And I believe we're heading in the right direction. I'm not going to tell you that everything is perfect in the New York State Assembly, but some assembly women have been quoted recently as saying that they have seen significant and profound changes. More needs to be done. So getting back, it kind of segues into what that question is, training. Before, they were doing large group training, kind of somebody standing up. This is the law. Nobody's really listening. Nobody's really learning much. And under the new policy, it's required that all the members participate every 2 years, every session that is, in a small group, 20 to 25 maximum people, interactive session that's facilitated by an experienced trainer who not only addresses what's appropriate and inappropriate conduct, what's lawful and unlawful, but also gets people to understand that we could grow up as boys and girls in this country, same family, we become men and women, but we have different experiences. And so the example I often give, a woman is going by a construction site. I ask people in my training sessions, raise your hand if you've ever heard lewd comments directed at you when you pass a construction site. Virtually every woman raises her hand. Men, how many of you? Nobody raises their hand. Now, it's not necessarily right or wrong of what happened to them at that moment, but what is important is that they've had different experiences.
Yeah.
And so in the workplace, you're going to get different interpretations and different understandings based on your gender lives and experiences. And so I need people to listen to each other and to talk to each other as human beings and start changing the
right,
culture.
Absolutely.
So the training is essential. And one of the
Professor Rosen, I'm so sorry. I've got to jump in here because we've run out of time. But this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. Rick Rosen, he's professor at the City University of New York Law School. He served on New York State's Task Force on Sexual Harassment, and he is the State Assembly's independent counsel there who handles investigations into all sexual harassment allegations in the New York State Assembly, trying to learn from what's happened in New York to see if we can institute any meaningful changes here in Massachusetts. So, Professor Rosen, thank you so very much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure being with you. Thank you.
You know, it's interesting in New York also, people are still suggesting even further reforms. We were reading today about ideas that some folks would like lawmakers' campaign accounts, which can be used to pay for lawmakers' legal defense, also be made available to harassment victims in the case of a settlement or civil rights violation. Now, they haven't done that in New York yet, but it's yet another idea up from our neighbors in the north. So lots for us to learn here, but we're going to move on to the day's other news. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The MBTA wants to move paying for transit fully into the 21st century. They're moving towards an all-electronic system. And by 2020, that means you could tap your smartphone or credit card to pay for your fare. The T will also introduce the next generation of Charlie cards and one that will be linked to online accounts. Now, here is another big change that would come with this cashless fare paying system. Buses, trains, and trolleys, would no longer accept cash payments. Now, these changes are being hailed by some as a needed step forward for the T, but other folks are worried that the modernization could disenfranchise some low-income riders. So let's talk about that. Joining me to do so is James Aloisi. He's former state transportation secretary. He's currently a principal at the Pemberton Square Group. Jim, it's good to have you back.
Nice to be back, Meghna.
And also with us is Mark Ibunya. He is the co-founder and president of Transit Matters, which advocates for better transit in Massachusetts. Mark, it's good to have you as well.
Yes, good afternoon. It's good to be here again.
Okay. So, Jim, let me just start with you. Overall, this sort of cashless fare system that the T is moving towards, good idea, right?
Well, so let me make a slight correction. It's not a cashless system. It's an excellent idea. So, and I think this is important.
It's a double correction there, but I'll take it.
Because you cannot use cash to board a bus or a light rail vehicle, but you can use cash to pay for your fare. So the system is not cashless. The system simply moves the use of cash from onboard the vehicle to either a fare machine or another point of sale.
Okay.
And by doing that, it will have the effect of allowing that bus to board at all doors and to move a lot more quickly, giving everybody a better ride.
All right. So sounds good. I mean, Mark, honestly, I wonder why we couldn't board at all doors now. Is it really just the cash part?
Right. Well, so the biggest concern right now is that the T doesn't have a way to make sure that those people who are entering through all doors have a way to participate in that fair payment system. So the sort of this opportunity for the T is to sort of wash their hands clean of the existing system, which is very, very expensive for them to buy new hardware, which... I've been following this for a while, and the T has been interested in buying more validators, doing all of these things on the Green Line and buses to speed this up, but it's always clocked in at a really, really expensive cost. And so what we're really getting here with the system is not just all-door boarding, but also, as part of the way that they've written this contract, more ways and more opportunities for people to load their cards.
Right. And so ultimately a great thing, right, at the price tag, by the way, of, what, more than $700 million to make this complete change. But, Jim, the concern is... We can talk about all the advantages, which I want to in just a moment, but isn't the concern that if you can't pay with cash on the trolleys, trains, or buses, that you actually are also limiting the most common point of contact that people have to pay for the T, and that could lead some riders to be at a disadvantage if they don't have a cashless machine, say, at their local stop?
Well, so the reason why I support what the T is doing is that it's actually going to improve access for those very same people. And why will it do that? We're going to pretty much be doubling the number of fare machines from the current almost 500 Carly Chard machines to about 840 fare machines. Plus, we're going to have the ability to use cash at any number of what's being called retail outlets. The retail outlets can be anything from your neighborhood CVS to your neighborhood senior center or library or nonprofit center.
Yeah.
So people are going to have, people who use cash today can use cash tomorrow, and they'll have many, many more opportunities, probably more than double, to access a point of sale for that. So this is going to improve access, not diminish it. And so if you are using cash, you're going to have two benefits. Your access to the fare machine is going to be improved, and your ride when you get on the bus is going to be improved.
I do want to acknowledge the concern of a lot of other advocates out there, including ourselves, about the way that the MBTA is communicating this. And this does need to be done in a way that ensures that those people who are never touching the subway, for example, those low-income riders who are only using the buses, that they know when and where they're able to load these their Charlie cards to add fare, in the language that they may be speaking, which may not necessarily be English.
Good point, because this is an extraordinarily important point, Mark, because it suddenly occurred to me that right now there are places, certain convenience stores, if I remember correctly.
A few of them, just
that
a
you
few.
Could, right now, that you could actually add fare through cash to your Charlie card at certain stores right now, but...
Right.
Hardly anybody knows about them because there aren't, I don't recall seeing giant signs outside of those stores saying, here, you can load up your card.
Right, right. And that's big. The big point that that Jim is trying to get to, which is that right now, again, the equipment is very expensive and very expensive for those bodegas to license.
Yeah.
So by having the equipment be cheaper and more and be written into the contract that there need to be more retail outlets, that you'll have more of them in your neighborhood. And I think an opportunity for us advocates is to make sure that the T is making sure that those are being communicated effectively to the people in the neighborhoods.
And Megna, I want to make a point, if I can, which is the RFP is does require that the contractor comply with very, very rigorous metrics. So, for example, the Silver Line 4 and 5 buses have to have a fare vending machine within 500 feet of every bus stop. Zone 1A, which encompasses the Fairmount line, again, through a disadvantaged community, has to have fare vending machines within a certain radius. There is also a metric that basically says 80% of the people standing in line to use a machine have to have a 1 minute or less wait. And if they don't, then you have to put in more machines.
Mm.
So there's a variety of metrics that they will hold the contractor accountable for that are designed to improve convenience and access. And I think the combination of this improved access and improved bus service is going to equal better social and modal equity. Because
yeah.
The thing that we need to do more in this in this region is show people across all spectrums that we can improve the quality and the reliability of the bus transit service. That's the next horizon in front of us. This new fare program will help us get there.
Right. You know, I was just looking at my notes here, and just to close this the loop on what we were talking about retail, Charlie cards sales a little earlier, the Globe reported a while ago that the T, with its current system, had actually had some limited success with agreements with retailers because a lot of them dropped out because they just earned, 1.8% commission for offering the service at their bodega, and that the Globe says that currently 160 retailers still provide the service for the T. But you're both saying that that number should go up significantly.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Now, Jim, about this idea of sort of reducing idle time for buses, and specifically buses, but also trains, and getting things moving more quickly and efficiently, reducing those dwell times, in other words. We actually spoke with Kimberly Barzola. She's an organizer for the T Riders Union, and she said, you know, that might be great, but saving riders a few seconds on their rides isn't necessarily high on their list of concerns. So here's what she said.
It's maybe a few more seconds, but that really isn't affecting why a bus is just not showing up all of a sudden. There's not enough buses coming per hour, or by the time the bus gets to you, it's already completely at capacity. Those issues aren't going to be addressed, you know, just by saving, you know, a few seconds.
Mark, what's your thought about that? Then I'll turn to Jim.
Yeah, sure. So buses spend actually up to a quarter of their time just sitting at the curb loading people onto the buses. And yes, while a few seconds here and there may not be so great for, you know, the everyday rider, a lot of those buses are unproductive. That is to say that they are just sitting stuck in traffic. So yeah, absolutely. The new fare system is not going to solve all the problems, but it is part of a number of different initiatives that the T is now engaged with. One of those being working with municipalities to make sure that buses that are full of passengers get priority over just general traffic, because those are the most productive vehicles on the road right now.
Yeah, and I know, Jim, that's something that you've been advocating for a long time.
Well,
I was going to give you a chance to respond to what Kim Barzola told us, but we're running out of time, Jim, and there's one more thing, important thing I want to get to. So,
All right.
I'm just executive decision here. Sorry about that. But the thing, the potential that this new fare collection system could provide the T in the future, and you know, I'm thinking of things like they could know potentially where passengers get on and off, right? Because you could do a tap out system as well.
Use that, sure.
Yeah. And then could that help the T move towards, I don't know, some sort of zoning when it comes to fare paying?
Yeah.
Well, it could. And again, I just want to underscore, this is one step and only one step in the direction toward improving the bus transit experience for T riders. Mark is right. All door boarding and no cash on board are important steps. Additional important steps include clearly dedicated lanes where cities and towns within the T service area have to cooperate with the T. With bus rapid transit, there are a variety, and transit signal priority, where the light turns green when the bus approaches. We need to employ and deploy all of those initiatives and strategies to make the bus system work the way it should.
Yeah.
But this system, I want to underscore, is the right step at the right time. It's not going to disenfranchise anybody, in my view, and I care about these issues deeply.
Yeah.
It's going to improve access and equity, and it's going to be the platform that I think allows advocates like Mark and myself to make the case that now is also the time that we need to accelerate dedicated bus lanes.
Yeah.
And signal priority to make the system function at a high level.
Well, Jim Aloisi, former state transportation secretary and principal at the Pemberton Square Group and a frequent contributor with us here at Radio Boston on all things MBTA. Jim, thanks so much.
Thanks, Magna.
And Mark Ibunya, co-founder and president of Transit Matters. Great to have you, Mark. Looking forward to doing it again.
Of course. Thank you so much.
We'll be back. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. We've got a really delightful conversation now because joining us in the studio is Gregory Maguire. Now, you know him from his reimagining of fairy tales from Cinderella to Snow White to Alice in Wonderland. And of course, There's his novel Wicked, about the early life of the Wicked Witch of the West, which was the basis for the smash Broadway musical. Well, now McGuire is taking on a holiday classic, The Nutcracker. His newest novel is called Hidden Sea, and it fills in the origin story of Herr Drosselmeyer, the toy maker who carves the enchanted figure in the Nutcracker. And Gregory Meyer is with us. McGuire, excuse me, is with us in the studio. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
It's really a pleasure to have you. All right, what is it about the Nutcracker that you thought needed the McGuire treatment?
I think probably it's that the Nutcracker has always spooked me, both as an implement, as a part of holiday decoration, and also as a story. Magda, did you go 300 or 400 times to see the Nutcracker when you were a kid?
I'm afraid to say I did not. Actually, I'm one of those weird outliers that didn't go see it a lot. But I know its draw to many, many people.
It is, and it's a wonderful story. But in my estimation, it offers more questions than answers. Now, maybe the best of all fantasy stories should do that, because they should leave us wanting more and leaning forward into mystery. That's what literature does for us. But the Nutcracker always seemed to me peculiarly sort of lopsided and gimpy. I wanted to take, in the story of the Nutcracker, that second act, which unfolds in Fairyland, I guess, or Candyland or someplace. I don't know where it is. They don't have any income taxes there. I know it's perfect. And I wanted to examine why going to a magic land is the proper solution and the proper reward for a girl in the first act who has suffered some sort of either psychic breakdown or some sort of real fight with the King of the Mice.
Yeah. So you do that. You explore that through telling the story of Herr Drosselmeyer. But why him? I mean, because I was reading one reviewer saying that they kind of wish you'd had applied your talents to telling the story of the Nutcracker, the soldier himself.
Yes, the soldier himself or the Sugar Plum Fairy, people have asked me to. And I said, well, who knows? There can be sequels. You never know. But Herr Drosselmeyer seems to me the biggest puzzle in the story. If you didn't see it multiple times, you might not know that he's characteristically figured with an eye patch over one eye. And he's tall and leering and a little menacing. He seems to know more than the girl's own parents. And I began to think, where did he come from? How did he get to have the leverage in this family that he seems to have?
Right. So I was wondering if you could do us the great favor of reading a little bit from Hidden Sea. This is early in the book where we're starting to get glimpses as to why Herr Drosselmeyer became who he is.
Exactly. And I will say that in this scene, he doesn't even have a last name yet. He's just a foundling boy in a Bavarian forest at the beginning of the 19th century. So here's the section. Dirk awoke one night to the sound of muttering below. He rolled on his pallet of straw in the loft and put his ear to a crack in the boards. The old man was fighting with the old woman. Dirk picked out a few words. Necessary? Feeble? Scarcity. Whispering can disguise the shape of syllables, but not of mood. Dirk heard fear and blaming. It reminded him of something, but of what did he have experience? But this hut in the black shrouded forest, these two elderly keepers. Only the occasional Bible story that Pappy read slowly by firelight. Elijah in disguise. Isaac and Abraham. Or the tales that the old woman told. Of the goose that laid the golden eggs. Of the 12 brothers turned into swans. Of the stepmother who stewed her children and served them to her husband for supper. A thin catalog by which to reference human charity and suffering. The old woman's sniveling gave way at last to an aching silence. None of the old man's heavy snoring, which meant he was lying awake, uncomforted, staring into the dark. In the morning, the old man said, Dirk, today I will take you into the forest and teach you to fell a tree. It is time. He did not say what it was time for. Dirk had always wanted to go with the old man and learn his skill. The old woman had always forbidden it. Today she turned to the iron pot over the hearth and said nothing, neither blessing the day's plan nor prohibiting it. Before they left, she wrapped bread and cheese in a muslin and pressed it into Dirk's hands. "Mind your way forward and find your way back," she said to them once they were over the threshold and through the gate. Did her voice quaver because her little foundling was growing up? Dirk wondered. He glanced back. She was not there, waving.
Wow. That is Gregory Maguire reading an excerpt from Hidden Sea, a tale of the once and future Nutcracker. So, if people couldn't already tell, my guess is if this gets made into another smash Broadway hit, it's not necessarily for the same kids who would go see the Nutcracker, right?
Well, I'm ready. The lines are opening.
But this is dark, right? And we got a hint in this passage of the fact that you've written this very much like a, is it fair to say, like a Grimm's Brothers tale?
Yes, it is fair to say that. Indeed, when I began my research, I found out that the original story of the Nutcracker by E.T.A. Hoffman, was published in 1816, which was only 2 or 3 years after the first edition of the first collection of the Grimm's Tales was published in German. The Grimms were collecting 1808, 1810, 1811, and Hoffman's tale of the story of the Nutcracker and the Mouse King was published in 1816. So I think Hoffman, like so many other German romantic writers, began to drink deeply from the well of folkloric passages and tropes and characters and begin to make something new out of them. It's really where we get literary fantasy from.
Right. So literary fantasy is one of those things which I think forces us to ask a question or maybe find an answer to a question which I know that you've asked. And I just want to, this is a quote from something you've written. You've written, "Is it only in childhood that we are capable of taking in the whole world? What does it do to us that we briefly have that privilege? And then what harm when the fund of novelty and human experience runs dry?"
I'm going to start crying at that idea. But we do, in fact, have this experience before, let's say before hormones, before we're 14 or 15, we have this experience of apprehending the mystery of the world, both through our senses, which are more or less scientific, and through our dreams and our more imaginative experiences. Our job as a sane human being is to learn to integrate both apprehensions, and that's what we hope to do. But in the integration, sometimes we do have to sacrifice something that, for lack of a better word, we might call faith, we might call magic.
And then as adults, though, there's that longing to return to definitive moments in our childhood, though, right? Because in the book, it seems as if one of the characters' lives either you state it directly or you imply this return, because it's the life is represented by a walnut, right?
Yes, yes.
And to crack that walnut is to...
It's true. And it's, in a sense, the walnut, the instrument for which the Clara and the mice are fighting, holds the secret of childhood. Mm-hmm. When we outgrow childhood, what we have left is something that is too often locked away inside of us. I think art and mental sanity help us to open the walnut of our childhood experiences.
What is your walnut?
Oh, that is that's got to be for a different hour. No, I will say, in fact, people who know me have known this. My mother died when I was born in childbirth. And my father put me in an orphanage for a while he was beginning to see how he could cope and survive and if he could. And so as I'm now the man in my sixth decade, or is it my seventh, I go back and I think that is the beginning of every fairy tale in the world. There's no wonder in my mind that when I went to the library, I never really graduated out of the fairy tale section. There was something about children whose mothers died in childbirth and had to make their own way that seemed to me like a biographical outline of my life.
Well, I'm pausing here because I wanted to say that I'm sorry for the difficulties that you had as a child, but I also want to say that you have managed to transform that into magic and wonder through your writing for the rest of us.
Well, so isn't that what a hero is supposed to do? Bring back a boon. And I thank you so much for reading my work and for admiring it. And just before the music, I'll say I had a very happy childhood despite all that.
I'm delighted to hear that. But Gregory Maguire, the new book is Hidden Sea, A Tale of the Once and Future Nutcracker. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Meghna.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.